said. "Tell me what you want to tell me. Tell me what you want me to know." "Ah, well, as I indicated, we were the rich exiles. You know the story. Nebuchadnezzar came down on Jerusalem and slew the soldiers and littered the streets with bodies, and left behind a Babylonian governor to rule over the peasants who would tend our estates and vineyards and send the produce home to his court. Customary. But rich men, tradesmen, scribes like the men of my family? We weren't slain. He didn't come sharpening his sword on our necks. We were deported to Babylon with everything that we could carry, I might add. Wagons of our fine furniture, which he allowed us to have, although he had thoroughly looted our temple, and we were given fine houses in which to live, so that we might set up shop and serve the markets of Babylon, and serve the temple and the court. This happened 1,000 times over in those centuries. Even the cruel Assyrians would do the same thing. They'd put to the sword the soldiers, and then drag off the man who knew how to write 3 languages, and the boy who could carve perfectly in ivory. And so it was with us. The Babylonians, they weren't as bad as other enemies might have been. Imagine being dragged back to Egypt. Imagine. Egypt, where people live just to die, and sing night and day of dying, and of being dead. And there was nothing but village after village and field after field. No, we didn't have it bad off. By 11 years old, I had been to the temple itself, a page, as many a rich Hebrew boy was, and I had seen the great statue of Marduk himself, the god, in his high sanctuary atop the great ziggurat of Etemenanki. I had entered into the inner shrine with the priests, and the strangest thought had occurred to me. This big statue looked more like me than the little one I had, which I had always thought bore a distinct resemblance. Of course, I didn't chirp this out loud. But as I looked up at the mighty Marduk, the great gold Marduk, the statue in which the god lived and ruled, and should have been carried each year in the New Year's procession, the statue smiled. I was too clever to say anything to the priests. We were in the process of preparing the inner sanctuary for the woman who would come and spend the night with the god. But the priests noticed something, and they saw me look at Marduk, and one of them asked, "What did you say?" And of course I'd said nothing. But Marduk had said, "Well, what do you think of my house, Azrael? I've been so often to yours." From that moment, the priests were on to it. Yet things might still have gone differently. I might have had a long human life. I might have had a different path. Sons, daughters, I don't know. At the time, I thought it was hilarious and wonderful, and loved Marduk for this little trick. But we continued to ready the chamber, which was truly magnificent in plated gold, and the silken couch where the woman would lie to be taken by the god that night. And then we left, and one of the priests said, "The god smiled on you." I was stiff with fear. I didn't want to answer. Rich Hebrew hostages, or deportees like us, were treated very well, as I said. But I didn't really talk to the priests, you know, as if they were Hebrews. They were the priests of the gods we were forbidden to worship. Besides, I didn't trust them, and there were too many of them, and some were very stupid, and others very sly and smart. I said simply that I had seen the smile too, and thought it was sunlight. The priest was quaking. I forgot about that for years. I don't know why I remember it now, except to say that that might have been the very moment when my fate was sealed. Marduk started talking to me all the time then. I'd be in the tablet house working hard, you know, learning thoroughly every text we possessed in Sumerian so that I could copy it out, read it, even speak it, though by then nobody spoke Sumerian. Ah, I must tell you a funny thing I heard only recently here in this 20th-century world. I heard it in New York in the days after it was all over, finished with. Gregory Belkin, I mean. And I was wandering around, trying to make my body take the form of other men, and it kept changing back. I heard this funny thing.
What?
I asked at once. That nobody even now knows where the Sumerians came from. Not even to this day. That they came out of nowhere, the Sumerians, with their language which was different from all others, and they built the first cities in our beautiful valleys. Nobody knows more about them even to this day.
That's true.
Did you know then?
No, he said. We knew what was written in the tablets, that Marduk had made people from clay and put life into them. That's all we knew.
But to find out 2,000 years later that you have no long archaeological or historical record for the origin of the Sumerians, how their language developed, and how they migrated into the valley and all of that, it's funny to me.
Well, haven't you noticed that nobody now knows where the Jews came from either? I asked.
Or are you going to tell me that you knew for a fact in those days when you were a Babylonian boy that God called Abraham out of the city of Ur and that Jacob did wrestle with the angel?
He laughed and shrugged. There were so many versions of that story. If you only knew. Of course people wrestled all the time with angels. That was beyond dispute. But what you have today in the holy books, it's remnants. The whole story of Yahweh defeating the Leviathan is gone. Gone. And I used to copy that story all the time. But I get ahead of myself. I want to describe things in some order. No, I am not surprised to hear that no one knows where the Jews came from. Because even then there were just too many stories. Let me tell you about my house. It was in the rich Hebrew quarter. I've explained what exile meant. We were to be citizens of quality, of a city filled with people of all nations. We were booty, set free to increase and multiply and make wealth. By my time, as you can guess, Nebuchadnezzar had died, and we were ruled by Nabonidus, and he was not in the city, and everybody hated him, just hated him. He was thought to be mad or obsessed.
This is told in the book of Daniel, though he is given the wrong name.
And true, our prophets did go try to drive him crazy with their predictions about how he ought to let us go home. But I don't think they got anywhere with him.
Nabonidus was driven by secret ideas of his own. Nabonidus was a scholar, for one thing, a digger into the mounds. And he was determined to keep Babylon in glory, yes. But he had a mad love for the god Sin.
Well, Babylon was Marduk's city. Of course there were many other temples and chapels, even in Marduk's temple, but still, for the king to fall crazy in love with another god? And then to go running off for 10 years, 10 years into the desert, leaving behind Belshazzar as the ruler. Well, that made everybody hate Nabonidus even more. The whole time that Nabonidus was gone, the New Year's festival couldn't happen. And this was the biggest festival in Babylon where Marduk takes the hand of the king and walks through the street with him. That couldn't happen with no king. And the priests of Marduk, by the time I came to serious work in the temple and palace, were really despising Nabonidus. And so were many other people, too. To tell you the truth, I never knew the whole secret of Nabonidus. If we could call him up, you know, as the witch of Endor called up the dead prophet Samuel, disturbing his sleep, remember, so that Saul the king could talk to him. If we could call up Nabonidus, he might tell us wondrous things. But that is not my mission now, to become a necromancer or a sorcerer. It's to find the stairway to heaven. And I am done with the fog and the mist in which the lost souls linger, begging for someone to call a name. Besides, maybe Nabonidus has gone into the light. Maybe he's mounted the stairs. He didn't live his life in cruelty or debauchery, but devotion to a god who was not the god of his city, that's all. I only saw him once, and that was during the last days of my life. And he was all caught up in the plot, of course, and he seemed to me a dead man already, a king whose time had passed, and he seemed also blessed with an indifference to life. All he wanted, on that last day when we met, or that night, was that Babylon would not be sacked.
That's what everybody wanted. That's how I lost my soul. But I'll come to that awful part soon enough. I was talking about being alive. I didn't give a damn about Nabonidus. We lived in the rich Hebrew quarter. It was filled with beautiful houses. We made the walls then about 6 feet thick, which I know sounds mad to you today, but you cannot imagine how effectively it kept our houses cool. They were sprawling affairs, with many anterooms and big dining rooms, and all these rooms surrounded a large central courtyard. My father's house was 4 stories high, and the wooden rooms above were full of cousins and the elderly aunts, and they often didn't come all the way down to the yard, but merely sat in the open courtyard windows taking the breeze. The courtyard was Eden. It was like a small portion of the hanging gardens themselves, and the other public gardens all over the city. It was big. We had a fig tree, a willow tree, and 2 date palms, and flowers of all kinds, grapevines covering the arbor where we could take our evening meal, and fountains that never stopped sending their rivers of sparkling water down into the basins where the fish darted about like living jewels. The brickwork was glazed and beautiful, and had many figures in it, having been built by some Akkadian before us, before the Chaldeans came. And it was full of blue and red and yellow and flowers, but there was also plenty of grass in the courtyard, and then the room off it where the ancestors were buried. I grew up playing among the date palms and flowers, and I loved it till the day I died. I loved lying out there in the late afternoon listening to the water of the fountains, and ignoring everybody who kept telling me I ought to be in the scriptorium copying psalms or some such. I wasn't lazy by nature. I just sort of did what I wanted to do. I got away with things. But I wasn't bad by any stretch. In fact, I was far and away the best scholar of the family, at least as I saw it. And many times my uncles, though they didn't want to admit it, would bring to me 3 versions of a psalm by King David and ask me which I thought was the most nearly correct, and then they'd follow my judgment. We had no official gathering place for prayers, of course, because we had such grandiose plans for going home and building the Temple of Solomon all over again. I mean, no one was going to throw up any little street-side temple in Babylon. The temple would have to be done according to sacred dimensions, and after I was dead and cursed and had become the servant of the bones, the Jews did go home and build that temple. In fact, I know they did, because I saw it once. Once, as if in a fog, but I saw it. In our Babylonian life, we gathered at private homes for prayers, and also for the elders among us to read the letters we received from the rebels still hiding on Mount Zion, and also the letters coming from our prophets in Egypt. Jeremiah was imprisoned there for a long time. I don't remember anyone ever reading one of his letters, but I remember a lot of mad writing by Ezekiel. He didn't write it down himself. He walked about talking and predicting, and then other people wrote it down. But so we prayed, in our homes, to our invisible and all-powerful Yahweh, reminded always that before David promised him a temple, Yahweh and the Ark of the Covenant had been housed only in a tent, and that had its meaning and its value. Lots of the elders thought the whole temple idea was Babylonian, you know. Go back to the tent. On the other hand, our family had for 9 generations been rich merchants, city men, living in Nineveh before Jerusalem, I think, and we had little concept of the nomad life or carrying about shrines and tents. The story of Moses didn't make a great deal of sense to us. For instance, how could the people be so lost in the desert for 40 years? But I repeat myself, don't I? What am I saying? A tent to me was all the silk over my bed, the red-tinged light in which I lay with my hands cupped under my head talking to Marduk about the prayer meetings and listening to his jokes. At some of these prayer meetings we had our own prophets, whose books are lost now, who did a great deal of ranting and screaming. I was frequently pointed to and told that I had found favor in the eyes of Yahweh, though what this meant nobody was certain. I guess they all knew in a way that I could see farther than others, look into souls, you know, see like a tzaddik, a saint. But I was no saint, only an obstreperous young man.
He stopped. The sharpness of memory seemed to cut him off and hold him.
"You were happy," I said. "By nature you were happy, truly happy." "Oh yes, I knew it, and so did my friends. In fact, they often teased me about being too happy. Things never seemed all that difficult, you see. Things never seemed dark. Darkness came with death, and the worst darkness for me was right before it, and maybe even now. But darkness... Oh, to take on the world of darkness, that is like trying to chart the stars of heaven. What was I saying? Things were easy for me. I enjoyed them. For example, to be educated, I had to work in the tablet house. I had to get a real Babylonian education. This was wise. This was for the future. This was for trade. This was to be a man of learning. And they beat the daylights out of us if we were late, or didn't learn our lessons, but usually it was easy for me. I loved the old Sumerian. I loved writing out the whole stories of Gilgamesh and In the Beginning, and copying all kinds of records so that fresh tablets could be sent to other cities in Babylonia. I could practically speak Sumerian. I could now sit down and write for you my life in Sumerian.
He stopped.
No, I couldn't do that. I couldn't, because if I could have written my life, I wouldn't have climbed up this snowy mountain to commit it to you. I can't write it in any tongue. Talking lets the pain flow.
That I understand perfectly, and am here to listen. The point is, you know Sumerian, and you can read it, and you can translate it.
Yes, 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 and Akkadian, the language that had been used after. And the Persian, which was creeping up on us all then, and Greek. I could read that well. And Aramaic, which was taking the place of our own Hebrew in daily life. But then I wrote Hebrew, too. I learnt my lessons. I wrote fast. I had a way of plunging the stylus into the clay that made everybody laugh, but my writing was good, really good. And I also loved to stand up and read out loud. So whenever the teacher took sick, or was called out, or suddenly needed some medicine, otherwise known as beer, I'd stand up and start reading Gilgamesh to everybody in an exaggerated voice, making them laugh. You know the old myth, of course, and it's important to our story, stupid and crazy as it is. Here is this King Gilgamesh, and he is running wild around his city. On some tablets he is a giant, on others he is the size of a man. He behaves like a bull. He has the drums beaten all the time, which makes everybody unhappy. You're not supposed to beat the drums except for certain reasons. To frighten spirits, to call to nuptials, you know. Okay, so we have Gilgamesh tearing up the city of Uruk. And what do the gods do, being the Sumerian gods, being about as smart as a bunch of water buffalo? They make an equal for Gilgamesh in a wild man called Enkidu, who is covered with hair, lives in the woods, and likes to drink with beasts. Oh, it is so important in this world with whom one eats and drinks and what. Anyway, here we have wild Enkidu coming down to the stream to drink with the beasts, and he is rendered tame by spending 7 days with a temple harlot. Stupid, no? The beasts wouldn't have anything to do with him once he knew the harlot. Why? Were the beasts jealous because they didn't get to lie with the harlot? Don't beasts copulate with beasts? Are there no beast harlots? Why does copulating with a woman make a man less of a beast? Well, the whole story of Gilgamesh never made any sense anyway, except as a bizarre code. Everything is code, is it not?
I think you're right, it's code, I said. But code for what? Keep telling me the story of Gilgamesh.
Tell me how your version ended, I asked. I simply couldn't resist the question. You know, we have only fragments now. And we don't have the old script that you had. It ended the same way as your modern versions. Gilgamesh couldn't resign himself that Enkidu could die. Enkidu did die, too, though I don't remember quite why.
Gilgamesh acted as if he'd never seen anybody die before, and he went to the immortal who had survived the great flood. The great flood. Your flood. Our flood. Everyone's flood. With us it was Noah and his sons. With them it was an immortal who lived in the land of Dilmun in the sea. He was the great survivor of the flood. And off to see him, to get immortality, goes this genius Gilgamesh. And that ancient one, who would be the Hebrew Noah for our people, says what? Gilgamesh, if you can stay awake for 7 days and nights, you can be immortal. And what happens? Gilgamesh instantly fell asleep. Instantly. He didn't even wait a day. A night. He keeled over. Smash. Asleep. So that was the end of that plan, except that the immortal widow of the immortal man who had survived the flood took pity on him, and they told Gilgamesh that if he tied stones to his feet and sank down in the sea, he could find a plant that, once eaten, gives you eternal youth. Well, I think they were trying to drown the man. But our version, as yours, followed Gilgamesh in this expedition. Down he went, and he found the plant. Then he comes up again. He goes to sleep. His worst habit, apparently, this sleeping. And a snake comes and takes the plant. Ah, what utter sadness for Gilgamesh, and then comes the old advice to all. Enjoy your life, fill your belly with wine and food, and accept death. The gods kept immortality for themselves. Death is the lot of man. You know, profound philosophical revelations. I laughed. I like your telling of it. When you would stand up in the tablet house, did you read it with that same fervor? Oh, always, he said. But even then, what did we have? Bits and pieces of something ancient. Uruk had been built thousands of years before. Maybe there was such a real king. Maybe. If I have a point in all this right now, let me make it. Madness in kings is common. In fact, I think sanity in kings must be rare. Gilgamesh went crazy. Nabonidus was crazy. You ask me, Pharaoh was crazy in every story I ever heard about him. And I understand this. I understand it because I have looked into the face of Cyrus the Persian and into the face of Nabonidus, and I know that kings are alone, utterly alone. I have looked into the face of Gregory Belkin, a king in his own right, and I saw this same isolation and terrible weakness. There is no mother, there is no father. There is no limit to power, and disaster is the portion of kings. I have looked into the face of other kings, but that we will pass over quickly later on, because what I did as the evil servant of the bones does not matter now, except that every time I killed a human life, I destroyed a universe, did I not? Perhaps, or you sent the evil flame home to be cleansed in the great fire of God. Ah, that is beautiful, he said to me. I was complimented. But did I believe this? So, let's go on with my life, he said. I worked at the court as soon as I left the tablet house, and then my writing and reading were of the utmost importance. I knew all languages. I saw many strange documents and old letters in Sumerian, and was useful to the king's regent, Belshazzar. No one much cared for Belshazzar, as I said. He couldn't hold the New Year's festival, or the priests didn't want him, or Marduk wouldn't do it. Who knows? But he wasn't destined to be loved. Yet I can't say this made for a bad atmosphere in the palace. It was fairly congenial, and, of course, the correspondence was endless. Letters were pouring in from the outlying territories, complaining about the Persians being on the march, or about the Egyptians being on the march, or about the stars as seen by various astrologists predicting very bad or good things for the king. I became acquainted in the palace with the wise men who advised the king on everything, and liked listening to them, and realized that when Marduk spoke to me, sometimes the wise men could hear it. And I also came to know that the story of the smile had never been forgotten. Marduk had smiled on Azrael. Well, what secrets I had! So look, I am walking home. I am 19. I have very little time left to live, and I don't know it. I said to Marduk, "How could the wise men hear it when you talk to me?" He said that these men, these wise men, were seers and sorcerers just as were some of our Hebrews, our prophets, our wise men, though nobody wanted much to admit it, and they had the power, as I did, to hear a spirit. He sighed, and he said to me in Sumerian that I must take the utmost care. These men know your powers. I'd never heard Marduk sound dejected. We had long ago passed the foolish point of me asking him for favors or to play tricks on people, and now we talked more about things all the time, and he frequently said that he could see more clearly through my eyes. I didn't know what this meant, but on this day, when he seemed dejected, I was worried. "My powers," I said sarcastically. "What powers?" "You smiled. You are the god." Silence, but I knew he was still there. I could always feel him, like heat. I heard him, like breath. You know, the way a blind person knows that someone is there. I got to my front door and was ready to go in, and I turned around, and for the first time I actually laid eyes on him. I saw Marduk. Not the gold statuette in my room, not the big statues in the temple, but Marduk himself. He was standing against the far wall, arms folded, one knee bent, just looking at me. It was Marduk. He was completely covered in gold, as he was at the shrine, but he was alive, and his curly hair and beard seemed not made of solid gold as they were on the statue, but living gold. His eyes were browner than mine, that is, paler, with more yellow in the irises. He smiled at me. "Ah, Azrael," he said. "I knew it would happen. I knew it." And then he came forward and he kissed me on both cheeks. His hands were so smooth. He was my height, and I was right. There was a great resemblance between us, though his eyebrows were set just a bit higher than mine, and his forehead was smoother, so he didn't look so mischievous or ferocious by nature as I did. I wanted to throw my arms around him. He didn't wait for me to say it. He said, "Do it. But for that moment, maybe others will see me too." I hugged him as my oldest friend, as the dearest to me in the world next to my father. And it was that night I made the mistake of telling my father that I talked with my God all the time. I should never have done that. I wonder now what would have happened if I had not done that. I interrupted. "Did anyone else see him, to the best of your knowledge?" "Yes, as a matter of fact, they did. The doorkeeper of our house saw him, and all but fainted dead away to see a man all covered in gold paint. And one of my sisters, looking down from the lattice above, saw him too. And an elder of the Hebrews got a glimpse of him for a moment, and came flying at me later that night with his staff, claiming he had seen me with a devil or an angel, and he did not know which. That's when my father, my beloved, sweet, good-hearted father, said, 'It was Marduk, Babylon's god, whom you saw.' And maybe that is why we are here now. My father never meant to hurt me. Never. He never meant to do a cruel thing to anyone in his life. He never meant it. He was my little brother. Let me explain. I have figured it out. I was the eldest son, born when my father was young, because the deportation from Jerusalem had been hard on our people, and they married quickly to have sons. But my father was the baby of his family, the little Benjamin beloved by everyone, and somehow or other in our family I fell into being his elder brother, and treating him as such. As eldest son I bossed him about a bit, or rather we became as friends. My father worked hard, but we were close. We drank together. We went to the taverns together. We shared women together. And I told him, drunk that night, how Marduk had talked to me for years, and how now I had seen him, and my personal god was the great god of Babylon himself. So foolish to have done it. What good could have come of it? At first he laughed. Then he worried. Then he became engrossed. Oh, I never should have done it. And Marduk knew this. He was in the tavern, but so far from me that he had no visibility. He was vaporous and golden like light. And only I could see him. And he shook his head no, and turned his back when I told my father. But you know, I loved my father, and I was so happy. And I wanted him to know. I wanted him to know how I had put my arms around the god.
Stupid.
Let me return to the background. The foreground is suddenly too hot for me, and it hurts me and stings my eyes. The family. I was telling you what we were. We were rich merchants, and we were scribes of our sacred books. All of the Hebrew tribes in Babylon were in one way or another scribes of the sacred books, and busy making copies for their own families at all times. But with us it was a very large business, because we were known for the rapid and accurate copy. And we had a huge library of old texts. I think I told you we had maybe, I don't know, 25 different stories about Joseph and Egypt and Moses and so forth, and it was always a matter of dispute what to include and what not to. We had so many stories of Joseph and Egypt that we decided not to give all of them credit. I wonder what became of all those tablets, all those scrolls. We just didn't think all those stories were true. But maybe we were wrong. Oh, who knows? But to return to the fabric of my life. Whenever I left the court of the palace, or the tablet house, or the marketplace, I came right home to work all evening on the Holy Scriptures, with my sisters and my cousins and uncles in the scriptoria of our houses, which were big rooms. As I told you, I was never very quiet, and I would sing the psalms out loud as I wrote them, and this irritated my deaf uncle more than anyone. I don't know why. He was deaf. And besides, I have a good voice. Yes, you do. Why should a deaf uncle get so upset? But he knew I was singing the psalms not as I just sang that one for you, but as one would sing with cymbals, dancing, you know, with a little bit of added dash, shall we say, and he wasn't so happy about it. He said that we were to write when we were to write, and to sing the Lord's songs at the appropriate time. I shrugged and gave in, but I was one for cutting up all the time. But I'm giving the wrong impression. I wasn't really bad. I know what kind of man you are, and were then. Yes, I think by now you do. And maybe if you thought me bad, you would have thrown me out in the snow. He looked at me. His eyes weren't ferocious. The brows were low and thick, but the eyes were plenty big enough beneath them to give him a pretty look. And it seemed to me that he was warmer and more relaxed now than earlier, and I felt drawn to him and wanting to hear everything he said. But I wondered, could I throw him out in the snow? "I've taken many lives," he said, plucking the thought right from me. "But I would not hurt you, Jonathan Ben Isaac. You know that. I wouldn't hurt such a man as you. I killed assassins. At least when I came to myself, that was my code of honor. That is my code now. In my early days as the servant of the bones, as the bitter, angry ghost for the powerful sorcerer, I killed the innocent because it was my master's will, and I thought I had to do it. I thought that the man who had called me up could control me, and I did his bidding. Until the moment came when I suddenly realized that I did not have to be a slave forever. That maybe, though my soul had been taken from my spirit, and my spirit and soul from my flesh, that perhaps I could still be pleasing to God. That somehow all could come and be united once more in one figure. Ah! He shook his head. But Azrael, maybe it's happened. Oh, Lord God, Jonathan, don't give me consolation. I cannot bear it. Just hear me out. Make sure your tapes record my words. Remember me. Remember what I say. His confidence broke suddenly. He looked at the fire again. My family. My father, he said. My father. How it hurt him what he finally did. And how he looked at me. Do you know what he said about hurting me? He said, Azrael, who of all my sons loves me as you do? No one else could ever forgive me for this but you. And he meant it. He meant it. My father, my little brother, looking at me full of tears and sincerity and absolute conviction. I'm sorry, I jump ahead. I'll die soon enough. It won't take too many more pages, I don't think." He shuddered all over, and again the tears stood in his eyes. "Forgive me, and recall again that for those thousands of years I didn't remember these things. I was the bitter ghost without memory. And now it has all come back to me, and I pour it out to you. I pour it out to you in tears." "Continue. Give me your tears, your trust, and your hurt. I won't fail you."
"Ah, you are the rare thing, Jonathan Ben Isaac," he said. "Not really. I'm a teacher and a happy man myself. I have a wife and children who love me. I'm not very special."
"Ah, but you are a good man who will talk to someone who is evil. That is what is rare. The Rebbe of the Hasidim, he turned his back on me." He laughed suddenly, a deep, bitter laugh. "He was too good to talk to the servant of the bones."
I smiled. "We are all Jews, and there are Jews, and there are Jews."
"Yes, and now Israelis, who would be Maccabees, and there are Hasidim.
And other Orthodox, and some Reformed, and so on it goes. Let's go back to your time. You were a big and happy family."
"Yes, true. And it was regular," I was explaining, "it was regular for the rich Hebrews to work at the palace, as I said. My father worked there too, and many of my cousins. We were scribes, but also merchants, merchants of jewels, silks, silver, and books. My father's gift in trade was choosing the very finest vessels for the king's table, and for the table of the gods in Marduk's temple, and for Marduk himself. Now, at the time, the temple was full of chapels, and every day a meal was set out for each deity, including Marduk. So the temple had a huge stock of gold and silver vessels for this, and my father was the one who put aside those vessels not fit. I went down with him to the docks all the time to meet the ships coming in from the sea, with the finest new work from Greece or Egypt. And I learned from him how to judge the carving on a goblet, and how to know the heaviest and finest mixture of gold. I learned to know a true ruby or diamond, and pearls. Pearls, I loved the pearls. We dealt in pearls of all kinds. We didn't call them pearls, you know. We called them eyes of the sea. This is how we made our living, in the marketplace, and in the temple, and in the palace. My family had stalls all through the marketplace where they dealt in gems of all kinds, in honey, and in cloth dyed purple and blue, the finest of all silk and linen. And they sold the incense, too, though they sold it to idolaters who would burn this incense for Nabu and Ishtar, and for Marduk, of course. But it was our living. It was our source of power. It was our way of staying together, of being strong so that one day we could go home. It was as important as the copying of the sacred books.
"It's an old tale," I said.
"This whole trade, by the way, gave to my own house a sumptuous quality that it might not have had, had we been camel breeders. And that you must understand, because the richness around us colored my father's values as much as mine. What I mean is, not only did we make money, but the house was always full of merchandise passing through. You know, here would be a magnificent cedar statue of the goddess Ishtar just come from Dilmun, and my uncle would keep it at home for a week or two, gracing the living room, before the sale was made. The place was full of beautiful footstools, delicate furniture from Egypt, the fine black and red urns and pots of the Greeks, and just about anything portable and ornamental and lovely to behold."
"You grew up on beauty, didn't you?"
"Yes," Asriel said, "I did. I really did. And I grew up, for all my smart talking and carrying on and flirting with Marduk, I grew up with love. My father's love. The love of my brothers, my sisters. The love of my uncles, even. Even my deaf uncle. Even once the prophet Azrael said to me, 'Yahweh looks at you with love.' So did the old witch, Asenath. Ah, such love."
He had come to a natural pause. He sat there, resplendent in the red velvet, hair glossy and natural,
and the pure skin of his young man's cheeks as soft as a girl's, I suppose. I must be getting old, because young men look to me now as beautiful as girls. Not that I desire them. It's only that life itself is lush. He was confused, in pain. I hesitated to press him. Then he parted his lips, only to be quiet. Chapter 3. What was it like roaming in the temple? The palace, I asked. The beautiful house I can envision. But the palace, was the palace plated in gold? Was the temple? He didn't respond. Give me pictures, Azrael. Take your time by means of images. The temple. Will you tell me what that was like? Yes, he said. It was a house of gems and gold. It was a world of the deep, vibrant gleam of the precious, of lovely scents and the sounds of harps and pipes playing. It was a world for the bare feet to walk on smooth tiles that were themselves cut in the shapes of flowers. He smiled. And, he said, it was a hell of a lot more fun than you might think. Not all that solemn. The two buildings were huge, of course. You know Nebuchadnezzar built the palace to the full glory of the past, or so he thought, and greatly expanded the private gardens. And the temple was the great building known as Esagila, and behind the building itself stood the big ziggurat, Etemenanki, with its stairway to heaven, and then its ramps going up to the very topmost temple of my great and favorite smiling god. The temple and the palace were full of locked and sealed doors. Some of these seals had not been broken in 100 years. And, of course, as you probably know, we had contracts made in this way, too, in that a contract could be written out on a clay tablet, dried, and then enclosed in a clay envelope with the same words on it, which was then dried, so that one could not get to the original tablet inside without breaking the envelope. So if some corrupt individual had made a change in the outer envelope, the sealed inside tablet would tell the truth. There was a lot of that at court. People bringing in contracts, breaking open the envelopes, discovering some wily bastard had made a change in the contract, and the king and his advisers and wise men passing judgment. I never followed out any condemned man to see him executed. As you said, I grew up on beauty. In the streets of Babylon I never saw the hungry. I never saw a wretched slave. Babylon was the city people dreamed of living in. Everyone was happy in Babylon, and under the protection of the king. But to return to your question, one could roam in the temple. One could just roam. I could creep in my fine jeweled slippers into the chapels where the other gods were, Nabu and Ishtar, and any god or goddess who had been brought from another city for sanctuary. You know that was happening. Cyrus the Persian was on the march most definitely, taking the Greek cities along the coast one after another. And so from all over Babylonia, frightened priests were sending their gods to us for protection, to the great gateway. And we had set up these visiting deities in chapels, and these chapels were full of twinkling light. This fear for the god, that the enemy would get him, it was very real. Marduk himself had for 200 years been a prisoner in another city, stolen and taken there, and it had been a great day for Babylon, long before my birth, when Marduk had been recovered and had been brought home. "Did he ever tell you about it?" I asked. "No," he said, "but I didn't ask him. We'll come to such things." As I was saying, I liked roaming about the temple. I took messages to the priests. I waited at table when Belshazzar dined. And I made friends of all the palace crowd, you might say, the eunuchs, the temple slaves, the other pages, and some of the temple prostitutes who were, of course, beautiful women. Now, all of this work I did in the temple and the palace, there was a Babylonian point to it. The government had a sensible policy. When rich hostages like us, rich deportees, were brought in not only to enhance the culture, Young men like me were always picked out to be trained in Babylonian ways. That was so that if or when we were sent back to our own city, or some distant province, we would be good Babylonians, that is, skilled members of the king's loyal service. There were scores of Hebrews at court. Nevertheless, I had uncles who went into a fury that my father and I worked at the temple. But my father and I, we would shrug our shoulders and say, "We don't worship Marduk. We don't eat with the Babylonians. We don't eat the food that the gods have eaten." And a good deal of the community felt the same way as we did. Let me note here this eating of food. It's still important for the Hebrews, no? You don't eat with heathens. You didn't then. And you didn't eat anything ever that had once been put before an idol. It was a big thing. As good Hebrews, we broke bread only with one another, and our hands were always washed carefully with ritual prayer before we took the food. And afterwards there was not one thing in our lives that was not permeated by our desire to praise Yahweh, our Lord God of hosts. But we had to survive in Babylon. We had every intention of returning rich to our homeland. We had to be strong. And that meant what it has always meant to the Hebrews. You must be powerful enough to disperse without being destroyed. Again came one of the inevitable pauses. He leant forward and stirred the fire, as people do when they want to think, and want to have the feeling of doing something. Stirring fires can give you that feeling, especially if you aren't drinking anything, clutching your coffee as if that were a full-time job the way I was doing. "You looked then exactly as you look now, didn't you?" I said, though this was a repeat question. It was one of those soft verbal signals. "God gave you all the right gifts, young man." "Yes," he said. I wanted now to be smooth-faced. I think I told you. But it doesn't seem to be in my luck. I came as myself this time, and I don't know even to this moment who called me. Why now? Why has my body come back around me? Why? I don't know. In the past, when I was called forth by sorcerers, they made me look the way they wanted, and that could be quite horrible. Seldom, if ever, did they wait, or take a deep breath, to see what I might look like on my own. I would be summoned in a specific form. "Azrael, servant of the golden bones which I hold in my hand, come forth in a blaze of fire and consume my enemies. Make of them cinders." That sort of chant. Whatever the case, in answer to your question, I looked exactly the same when I died as I do now, except for one salient characteristic which had been added to me before my murder, which I will recount later. I am as I died. Your father. Why was it a mistake to tell him about Marduk? Why? What did all that mean? What did he do to you, Azrael? He shook his head. This is the hardest part for me to tell you, Jonathan Ben Isaac. But I have never told anyone, you know. I never told any master. Does God never forget? Will God deny me forever the stairway to heaven? Azrael, let me caution you, simply as an older human being, though my soul may be newborn. Don't be so sure of heaven. Don't be any more sure of the face of our God than Marduk was sure. This means you believe in one and not the other? This means I want to blunt your pain in the telling of what happened. I want to blunt your sense of fatality, and that you are destined for something terrible because of what others have done. Wise of you, he said, and generous in spirit. I am a fool still in so many ways. I see. I understand. Let's go back to Babylon, shall we? Can you explain the plot? What did your father have to do with it in the end? Oh, my father and I, what friends we were! He didn't have a better friend than me, and my best friend was Marduk. I was the leader on our drinking jaunts, and it was he, it was only he who could have ever made me do what I did, the thing which made me the servant of the bones. Strange how it all comes together. He felt a murmuring,
He was distracted.
They choose ingredients, and they blend them, because the potion won't work unless you have everything. The priests alone, they could never have gotten him to do it.
Cyrus the Persian? I trusted him as much as any tyrant.
And old Nabonidus, what was his advice?
He was only there out of some sort of kindness on the part of Cyrus, and cleverness. Everything with the Persian Empire was cleverness. Perhaps it's so with all empires.
Take your time, I said. Catch your breath.
Yes.
Let me give you pictures of my family.
My mother died when I was young. She was very sick, and she cried that she wouldn't live to see Yahweh lift his face to us again and take us back to Zion. Her people had all been scribes. She herself was a scribe, and at one time, I heard, had been something of a prophetess. But this had ceased when she had sons. My father missed her unbearably until the last day I ever knew him. He had two Gentile women, and so did I. In fact, we shared the same two women most of the time, but this was not for having children or marriage. This was just for fun. And at home in the family, my father was a hard worker at writing down the Psalms and trying to get exact the words we remembered from Jeremiah over which we all argued night and day. My father seldom, if ever, led the prayers. But he had a beautiful voice, and I can still remember him singing the Lord's praises. When we worked in the temple, it was secret between him and me that we thought all idolaters were completely crazy. And why not work for them and humor them? As I was explaining, we set our meal out for the god Marduk himself from time to time with the priests. I had many, many friends among the priests, and you know it was like any group of priests. Some believed it all, and some believed nothing. But we drew the veils around the god's table, and then afterwards we took away the food, which of course the god Marduk in his own way had actually savored and fed upon, through fragrance and through the moisture that he could feel. And we helped set up that meal for the members of the royal family, the royal hostages, and the priests and the eunuchs who would eat the god's food, or eat at the king's table. But again, as good Hebrews, we didn't eat that food ourselves. No, we would never have done that. We kept to the laws of Moses in every way that we could. And days ago, when I found myself pitched down into New York, and I began my journey to find the killers of Esther Belkin, when I happened upon the grandfather of Gregory Belkin, the Rebbe in Brooklyn, I saw that many of those Jews, strict as they were, had made a living in the big city of New York in Handel, as we would call it, just as we did in Babylon. And I saw also that there were Jews at all levels of devotion, as you yourself said. He stopped again. He was not anxious for the pain to come.
But let me get back to Babylon.
Look, I'm dancing in the tavern with my father. All men are dancing there together, you know. No harlots there that night. Just a man's place. And I tell him, I saw my God with my own eyes. I saw him, and I held him to my heart. Father, I am an idolater, but I swear to you I saw Marduk, and Marduk walks with me.
And there in the far corner, look, Marduk turns his back on me deliberately, and he shakes his head.
And hours later my father and I were still arguing. You are a wise man, you are a seer, and you have misused your powers, he said. You should have used them for us.
I will, Father. I will use them for us. But tell me, what do you want me to do?
Marduk asks nothing of me. What do you want me to do?
The following day Marduk appeared just a few blocks from the house, vaporous, gold, visible, however. He cautioned me. Don't touch me, or we will have a religious spectacle on our hands.
Look, are you angry with me for telling my father? I asked him straight away.
We were walking just like friends, and to have him visible was such a comfort to me.
No, I'm not angry with you, Azrael. It's just I don't trust the priests of the temple. There are many, many old and conniving priests, and you never know what they will want of you.
Now listen to me. I have some things to tell you before we get deeper into this.
Before you do, that is. For I am as deep as I can get. Let's go to the public gardens. I like to see you eat and drink.
We went to his favorite place, a huge public garden right on the Euphrates, down away from all the docks and the shipwrights and the commotion. In fact, it was where one of the many canals came in, and it was more on the canal than the river itself, which was always busy. This garden was filled with big, drooping willow trees, just like in the psalm, you know. And there were a few musicians out there playing their pipes and dancing for trinkets.
Marduk sat down opposite me and folded his arms. We really did look so much alike that we could have been brothers. It occurred to me that I knew him better than I knew any of my brothers. And by the way, I didn't hate my brothers the way Hebrews are always hating their brothers in the stories. Forget that. I loved my brothers. They were a little tame when it came to drinking and dancing. I had more fun with my father. But I loved them.
He stopped. It seemed out of respect for the dead brothers. He was now beyond beautiful in the red velvet, and these pauses brought me back visually to him in a way that was seductive. But then he began to talk again.
Marduk started in on me right away.
Look, I am going to tell you the truth, and you pay attention. I have no memory of my beginnings. I have no memory of slaying Tiamat the great dragon, and making the world out of her belly and the sky out of the rest of her. But this does not mean that it didn't happen. I walk most of the time in a fog. I see the spirits of the gods and the roaming spirits of the dead, and I listen for prayers and I try to answer them. But this is a dreary place where I live. When I retreat to the temple for the banquet, it's a great pleasure because the fog clears. You know what clears it?
No, but I can guess. That the priests see you, that powerful seers see you.
That is it, Azrael. I can become solid and visible for witches, for sorcerers, for those who have eyes to see. And then I drink up the libations of water. I inhale them and inhale the fragrances of food, and this puts me in the mood of life. Then I go into the statue, and I rest in darkness, and time means nothing to me, and I listen to Babylon. I listen. I listen. But the myths of the beginning, I don't remember. You see what I'm saying?
Not entirely, I confessed. Are you telling me that you aren't a god?
No, I am a god, and a powerful one. Were I to draw on my will, I could clear this marketplace, this garden now, with a great forceful wind. Easy to do. But what I am saying is that gods don't know everything, and this story of how Marduk became the leader of the gods, how he slew Tiamat, how he built the tower to heaven. Well, I've either forgotten it, or I am growing weak, and I can't remember. Gods can die. They can fade, just like kings. They can sleep, and it takes much to wake them up. And when I awake and am fully alert, I love Babylon, and Babylon loves me back.
Look, my lord, I said, you're weary because the New Year's festival hasn't been held in 10 years, because our king Nabonidus has neglected you and your priests. That's all. If we could get the addle-brained old idiot to come home and hold the festival, you would revive. You would be filled with the life of all those in Babylon who would see you on the processional way.
That's a nice idea, Azrael, and there's some truth in it. But I have no love for the New Year's festival, for residing in the statue and holding hands with the king. I get tempted in the very middle of it to knock the king down and away from me and right to the gutters of the processional way. Don't you see? It's not what they tell you. It's not.
He then went silent with a gesture to me to ponder these words, and then he said he wanted to try something. These next few moments were to have a crucial influence over my own destiny as a spirit, but I couldn't have known it then.
Azrael, he said, I want you to do this. Look at me, and strip me in your mind of this gold, and see me pink and alive as you are, with my beard black and my eyes brown. And then reach out and touch me with both your hands,
Let the god out of the gold. Let's try it.
I was trembling.
Why are you so scared? Nobody will see anyone across from you but a noble in fine dress, that's all.
I'm scared because it might work, my lord, I told him, and the most troubling thought has come to me. You want to escape, Marduk. You want to get away. And if this works, if my eyes and my touch can render you a visible body, you can escape, can't you?
And why the hell does that frighten a son of Yahweh?
He took in his breath.
I'm sorry I was angry with you. I love you over all my worshippers and all my subjects. I'm not going to abandon Babylon. I will be here as long as Babylon needs me. I will be here when the sands come to bury us all. And then maybe I will escape. But yes, this would give me freedom. It would teach me that as a god I could slip into a visible human body and walk about. It would teach me something about what I can do, you see. I can make storms. I can heal sometimes, though this is very, very tricky. And I can make wishes come true because I know things. And I know the demons the people fear are just the restless dead.
This is true? I asked him.
But let me say here that in Babylon, getting rid of demons was a big business. I mean, men made fortunes getting rid of demons from houses and sick people and so forth. There were rituals and charms for it, and you went to the exorcist and you did what he said. So I wanted to know if there were no demons. But he didn't answer me right away.
Then he spoke up.
Azrael, most of the demons are the restless dead. But there are strong spirits, spirits as strong as gods, and some of them are full of hate and like to hurt. But most of the time they don't bother with making a milkmaid sick or cursing a little house. That's the mischief of the restless dead. And the restless dead need to make mischief so that the fog and the smoke in which they wander will lift.
I didn't wait any further. I was impressed with his generosity and patience with me. And you must realize how splendid he looked sitting there, covered and permeated with gold, this beautiful, noble creature, that I loved him with a beating heart. I loved him with tears. I loved him with laughter. I reached out, and as I touched him, I asked that all the gold covering him be stripped, and that he have the freedom of a man to walk amongst us.
Can you guess what happened?
He became visible as real, I said.
He did. And I learnt something then about spirits that I was later to use to my advantage, and used up till not very long ago.
He did. He became visible. A great noble gentleman in festival dress sitting opposite me at the marble table with the wine cup in front of him. And he smiled. There was a stir all around as people saw him and took notice. I don't think they had seen him materialize, as we would say in this day and age. They just noticed him, for he was beautiful.
Was it clear that he was Marduk? I asked.
No. Without the gold he could have been a king, an ambassador. You know. The statue, you see, it was more stylized, remember. But everybody saw him. Even the musicians stopped their piping until he turned his head and gave a gesture for them to go on. And they saw him. And they went on. I was frozen with anxiety.
Come on, friend, he said. I see more clearly than ever. And though this body is light, I like the form of it. And it draws eyes to me which give me power, such as the New Year's procession itself gives. They see me.
They don't know who I am, but they see.
Come on, friend, let's walk. I want to walk up on the walls and through the temple with you. I want to see things clearly now with you.
You don't have to take me into your home. Your uncles will all go crazy. Unfortunately, I can hear with this god's ears that they are already gathering the wise men of Judea to talk about you, and that you can see and hear the pagan gods. Come on, let's go. I want to walk.
He stood up and put his arm around me,
and we strolled out of the garden. We walked all afternoon. I asked him, "What happens if you don't go back to the temple for the morning feast?"
"Idiot," he said, laughing, "you know perfectly well what happens. I just smell the food, I don't eat it. They'll lay it down before the statue and take it away and bring it to all the temple personnel who are to eat from the table of God. Nothing is going to happen."
We walked all over the quarters of Babylon, along the canals, the river, over the bridges, through different districts, and through the marketplace, and through the many open gardens and parks. He was staring wildly at things. And now, of course, spirit that I am, I know what it was like for him to see these vivid colors. I understand better what he had endured. Suddenly, near the Ishtar gate, he stopped in his tracks. "Can you see that?" And I did see it. It was the goddess herself. She was glowering at both of us. She was caked with gold and jewels, and invisible. In fact, I could see through her angry face. "Ha! She doesn't like it, what I'm doing, that I escaped." He stopped and began to worry. He then took on for the first time the look of fear. No, not fear. Apprehension. He became guarded. And I saw why. Many spirits were now around us, looking at him, and envying him and challenging him with their furrowed brows. And gods were there. The god Nabu was there. I saw him. And suddenly I saw the god Shamash. Now all of these were Babylonian gods, and they had their own temples and priests. But I could see they were angry at us. "Why aren't you afraid of them, Azrael?" Marduk asked me in a confidential breath. "Should I be, my lord? First of all, I am with you. And second of all, I am Hebrew. They are not my gods." This struck him as hilarious, and he began to laugh and laugh. I hadn't heard him laugh since he had become visible. "That's a perfect Hebrew answer," he said. "Yes, I think so too," I said. "My lord, would I offend them if I tried not to see them? Would you offend them if you banished them?" "No, I am the great God here." And he did make a decisive and angry and bold gesture, and the spirits turned pale and like smoke, even the angry, angry Shamash, and they vanished. But what lingered was the dead, everywhere the restless dead. He opened his arms and he conveyed blessings on them. He began to talk in Sumerian, and he gave blessing after blessing. "Return to your slumber, return to your rest in the Mother Earth, return to the peace of your graves, and to the safety of the memories of you in the hearts and minds of your children." And thank God these dead people all went away. Of course, he and I were standing there, plainly visible, and attracting much attention. This noble lord who made extravagant gestures to people nobody could see, and this rich Hebrew, overladen with jewelry, standing there like his page or companion or whatever. But the dead did fade. My heart sank. I remembered the ghost of Samuel, when he had been called forth by the witch of Endor for King Saul. He had said, "Why do you disturb my rest?" Oh, but the woe of this rest! I didn't want to be dead. I didn't. I didn't want to be dead. I reached out and clutched his hand. Marduk was, of course, stronger now.